Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 299, and we're going to talk about the high cost of cheap gear. This is a term you hear where you buy a tool once and you buy it for life, or is that not true? We're also going to talk about how to read reviews for product. There are a lot of people lying out there to you. How do you sort through that? And we're going to visit a place that is in more than one place, but might be really good for your van life. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Very happy to be here with you again. It is crazy hot right now in Chicago, and I am hiding in my office with the air conditioner on and the shades down. And if you're out there on the road and you're fighting this, well, I have sympathy for you because, yikes, it's pretty bad. And that is the lead-in for a podcast about air conditioning. And yeah, no, I got nothing for you, folks. I've said everything I can say about that. 12-volt air conditioning is becoming more and more of a reality, but at some point, it's just too darn hot outside. And heck, don't feel bad about getting a hotel if you have to, because sometimes it's worth it, and we should be glad they're there. Just a quick story about that. When I lived in Utah and Salt Lake City, we did not have air conditioning. I had what's known as a swamp cooler, a window swamp cooler, and you would add 2 liters of water to it, and it would last for 8 hours. And since I worked nights and slept during the day, that was super important, and it would last exactly as long as I needed to sleep. But it wouldn't cool the whole house. It would only cool one room. And what we ended up doing was we went to the movies on hot days when we were both home. And there was a dollar theater right around the corner from where we lived in Sugar House called Cinemark, common name. And we could go in and just watch like 3 movies for $1 each, although it was not hard to cheat. We didn't cheat, but it wasn't hard. And that's how we beat the heat. So if you're out there fighting it, don't forget that you have options. You don't have to be in the van. There are other places to go. Libraries. In Chicago, there are community centers that are open as cooling centers. Even the courthouses are open. You can just chill out in there, enjoy the free Wi-Fi, and just get the heck out of the steaming oven that might be your van. Okay, that said, let's take a look at cheap gear. Now, van life, this is a very much a place where there is cheap gear. We talk about the cheap Chinese diesel heaters all the time. You can get a Webasto or an Epispatcher for $1,500, or you can get the cheap Chinese diesel heater for $79. Which is better? I will tell you right now that the Epispatcher and the Webastos are better products. They have tighter engineering. They have more support. They're nicer. However, they break. So do the cheap Chinese diesel heaters. That's the reality of this high entropy device that is a heater. So which should you buy? And my argument is that you can buy a whole lot of cheap Chinese diesel heaters for the cost of one Eberspatcher. And even if you have to replace it 5 times, you're better off. You've saved a whole bunch of money. And they work well enough. So that's an example we talk about all the time. The only reason to get an Eberspatcher or a Webasto, in my opinion, is, one, you don't like the theft of intellectual property, which is what's going on here, or two, you are in a situation where you need the best gear, period, regardless of cost, which there are cases like that. If you're going deep off-road where you're going to have no support and you don't have space to store an extra Chinese diesel heater, that might be the way to go. Although, I'm going to argue that $79 is cheap insurance, and if you do have an Eberspatcher or a Webasto, you might want to consider carrying the cheap Chinese diesel heater too. It would be a good thing in an emergency, and you would already have all the stuff in place. It wouldn't take very long to change that out at all. So, buy once, cry once. You've heard that, right? Is it true? Well, in the example we've just talked about, I would say no. I would say in that case, no, but it varies greatly depending on what you're doing. And some of the criteria you need to look at are, how important is this thing to you? You know, like curtains are important, but how important are they? What is the cost of switching them? You know, what if you buy curtains you don't like? Is that a big deal? Versus, say, cookware, where you're going to use it all the time, and if it fails, that becomes a nuisance. What about storage bins? You can spend a lot of money on storage bins or a little bit of money on storage bins. Which should be more? basic hand tools. You know, do you want to buy brand name vice grips, or are the cheap ones that don't really have a name good enough? And it's almost a case by case thing. And so I'm just going to list some cases to kind of illustrate the point, because there is no, here's the rules, follow these rules and you'll be fine for this type of a thing. It's very much a personal decision. It's about what matters to you. And everything is different, because like in the example of the heaters, the cheap ones are what I would recommend. First thing I want to talk about is whatever you're sleeping on. You are going to spend a lot of time sleeping in your van. That's almost the main point of doing this. You want to be comfortable. It is important that you be comfortable. You will hate van life if you can't be comfortable while you're sleeping. So because of that, I recommend you get the best possible, be it a mattress or a futon or however you're handling the sleeping thing. Do not skimp there. That doesn't mean just buy the most expensive thing. You don't have to go and get the $1,500 custom-made mattress, which is actually what's in my Winnebago. The guy who owned it before me spent a ton of money on a custom mattress. And yes, it is comfortable. But I think I could find a comfortable mattress for $200. I don't think that much money needed to be spent. So, but that's an area I wouldn't skimp. Sleeping. Just remember how much time you're spending sleeping. A comfortable mattress or foam pad or whatever is super important. In my first rig, I went through 3 different beds in my Envy 200 because that was such an important issue. The first one I bought worked. It fit. It met all the criteria, but it was not comfortable. And then the second one kind of didn't fit right. And then I finally found the third one, which was this flip over futon thing from IKEA that was comfortable and worked. It cost money to do that. I had to buy 3 different beds, but it was worth it. It made the van comfortable. And that is hugely important. Another thing that is easy for me is multi-tools. I own many multi-tools now, and I like Leatherman brand. That is my brand of multi-tools. But it's not because I am a brand loyal guy. I am not a brand loyal guy. It's because they have consistently been very good products over the years that I've owned them. Yeah, I've had some problems with them. I've had some things break, and sometimes the way they're set up isn't ideal, blah, blah, blah. But I can tell you that every single cheap multi-tool I've had, and you get them for free sometimes, people give them to you, whatever. I have a pile of them. They all, what's the technical term? They suck. No, seriously, any $20 multi-tool is going to suck. Now, I'm talking about full-size or at least mid-size multi-tools here. If you get a little $20 tool, like one I recommended that you can take on airplanes that doesn't have a blade, that's fine. That's kind of a different thing. I'm talking about the tool you're going to be using all the time as you're building out your van and as you're just maintaining your van. Spend money on that. Leatherman products have gone way up in price, which is a shame. And they're not even made in the USA anymore. That was one of their big pride things. But no, now they're made in China, like everything else. And the price has gone up. So the savings was not passed on to you in that case. It probably went to some private equity dude so he can get a second yacht. However, I have a couple of Leatherman, and that Leathermans, the guy's name was Leatherman. It's hard to say Leathermans, but that's actually accurate. And they are excellent. And they were very expensive. One of them was a gift, and I don't know exactly how much it cost, but it was a very, very nice gift because I know it wasn't cheap. And the other one is my Leatherman Wave Plus, which is a mid-size tool, but the thing is solid. And it was like $110. It's a lot of money. But because of how I use it, it's well worth it to spend that. Now, not everyone has that kind of budget. I get it. $110 for a multi-tool seems crazy. But you can look and find some mid-range that is better. Read reviews, and we'll talk about that in a bit later in the podcast. But read reviews. Try them out if you can. Don't be afraid to return them if you don't like them. Amazon's got great return policies. If you get one you don't like, you can just send it back and get another one. That's all fine. But that's something I wouldn't skimp on. It's very, very important. Another thing I don't think you should skimp on is fans. And this is a bit tricky because I've been giving conflicting advice there. Fans you shouldn't skimp on in that you should not install anything permanently that is not good quality, aka cheap. So let me be very specific about this. Max Air fans, Fantastic fans, any of the fans you mount in your ceiling have 2 costs. There's the cost of the product, but there's also the cost of the installation. If you need to replace one of those, that's a pain in the butt. You don't want to have to do that. So you do want to get the right product there. That said, MaxAir fans fail all the time, and Fantastic fans are kind of weird. I mean, I've got them in the Airstream, and they've got like 6 knobs and buttons, and none of them are labeled, and you have to do the right combination to get them to work, and I don't know. I suppose you learn that over time, and that's not that big of a deal, but it's weird. However, both of them, when they're working, perform excellent, and I haven't had any serious problems with them, though I know other people have. I don't regret those purchases. I don't regret spending a few $100 on a good fan. And I know you can get them cheaper. And I've seen, you know, this very simple 14-inch vents that have a little tiny, almost like a computer fan in there. I mean, yeah, you can do that. You're not going to get any we're near the airflow you get from the others. And those little fans, motors, they just seize up after time. They just don't last as long. Just on a side note, you can make your own. That is totally legitimate. If you want to just get a 14-inch vent and then attach a bunch of pancake fans, which we also call computer fans, that is not a bad solution because those pancake fans are meant to be on all the time. And if you did it in the right way, you could actually replace them if they wore out. So anyway, that's a different podcast. So you do have to evaluate every single thing. Now, there are some less obvious places where you would think you could get away with being cheap and you really shouldn't. For example, storage bins. When I first built out my NV200, it was a no-build, and I had just those Sterlite storage bins you can get from Target or Walmart or whatever. They're not that expensive, and they come in racks, and it's dead simple to buy this and plop it in your rig and say, good, I'm done, I've got my drawers. And then I used my camper in winter, and when I pulled on the handle, it ripped right off because that plastic gets very, very brittle when it was cold. So was that a good buy? It was only $20 for this rack. No, it was a bad buy because it broke and I don't have it anymore. I couldn't use it. So no, that was a very good case of where something cheap was not a bargain. I ended up replacing it with stuff from IKEA. And I know you're saying, well, how is that better? IKEA makes crap. No, I get that. The IKEA conversation is also the topic for another podcast. But the IKEA stuff was strong enough and exactly the right size. And more importantly, I could fix it. I could reinforce where it was weak and it worked just fine. So that was how I dealt with that. But the IKEA stuff was a lot more expensive than the Sterlite. So that's where I ended up there. If I had the time and money and skill and talent, I would have rather custom built cabinetry, but I don't have that. It's not something I can do. Another thing, and this has caught me, is don't buy cheap steps. Now, I have recommended them in the past. In fact, I should probably be very clear that these plastic steps that I've recommended in the past, the kind you get them for like $6 at Harbor Freight. They fold up. They're very simple. You put them by your door. I've had two of them break under my weight now. And I'm not the lightest guy in the world, but they shouldn't do that. One of them was in the cold. Again, cold and plastic is a non-obvious thing you have to watch out for. But the other one didn't really have an excuse. It was just a sudden failure. And that's not good. Now, that said, what did I do? I went and bought another one. For my trip in RMSS, I bought another one of those cheap folding steps because I knew I needed it and it was available. And I just grabbed it and put it in there and I made it work and it worked for the weekend. And that was not a good investment. I know I'm going to replace this thing. In fact, I already have. I have another ladder to replace it. It's a Costco, not no T in there, Costco folding ladder that will probably last forever. And yeah, I should have just done that in the first place, but I would have had to have planned a separate trip or a separate purchase. There are circumstances in which you will buy cheap stuff and then get rid of it, and it's okay. You know, there are no rules or judges here. There's only hoping for the best outcome. Folding tables are similar. Remember that cheap folding tables can't handle very much weight, and they're going to have a problem in the cold as well. But if it's something you use once a month, yeah, maybe it's worth it to get the cheap one, but consider that. Also, there are things where if it breaks, you're in big trouble. So let's talk about those a little bit. Tire inflators, you can get the cheap little tire inflator that plugs into the cigarette lighter and put it under your seat. And then, uh-oh, you get a flat tire. Okay, that's all right. You got the plugs. You're going to plug the tire and you're going to go to inflate it. And then the fuse in the 12-volt adapter that goes in the cigarette lighter has popped. And it's one of those weird glass fuses and you don't have any of those. And suddenly you're stuck because you can't make that work without doing some creative wiring, which is what I would do in that case. Think about that. Think about battery chargers. You know, I always recommend you carry around a cheap solar controller with you whenever you're out on the road, because they're 10 bucks, they're tiny, and if your solar controller fails, you can get by with one of these until you can get your solar controller sorted out. But I wouldn't recommend getting a very cheap solar controller for long-term use in any but the simplest rigs, because that $10 controller can break at any moment. It'll just stop working. This has been reported many, many times. And while it's never happened to me, it is definitely something that should be planned against. You should actually buy two whenever you buy one, because they're so cheap. And an MPPT controller, of course, is always going to be better than a PWM controller, and you're going to be spending in the neighborhood of $100 at least for those. They're bigger, etc., etc., etc. Water hoses is another one. Cheap water hoses will be the bane of your existence if you have a problem with them. And I find that just the standard Home Depot water hoses have been fine for my van life use, but I do have a very nice collapsible 50-foot white hose that isn't the really cheap ones. There are some really cheap versions of these that don't work as well. This one was a kind of a ruggedized version of those. I think I spent $50 on it. And I love this thing because it coils up into a nice tight package. It doesn't take up very much space. It's neat, and it always works. It doesn't leak. I know how its characteristics are. I've used it in cold weather and hot weather, and it's always been fine. I think that was probably something I was glad to spend more money on. And then there's just some basic safety things like jack stands. I don't know if you remember, but Harbor Freight used to sell, well, they still sell cheap jack stands. And those things are made with cast iron, and they have a mold, and they, you know, would melt the iron into the mold, basically. All right, it's probably steel, but you know what I mean. And then out it comes, and they did this so many times that the molds wore out, and that made these jack stands unsafe. And if you put too much weight on them, they would collapse, which is kind of not the point of a jack stand. They're there to not collapse. So that kind of stuff that's actually going to save your life, you don't want to be too cheap on. And while Harbor Freight's quality is variable, and there are definitely times I would recommend Harbor Freight stuff, in that case, it just illustrates that buying the cheapest possible jack stand was a problem. And that applies to tires, too. You don't want to buy the cheapest possible tires for your rig. The tires are the only thing connecting your vehicle to the road, and at 70 miles an hour, you want something pretty solid. Having said all that, you may have noticed that there is a solution to this. You don't want to spend too much money, but you also don't want to spend money on stuff that's not going to work. So what's a good strategy? Well, if you can, consider buying stuff used. It's always tricky. You don't know its history. You don't know what's happened to it. But for certain items, used is going to be better. For example, a used Leatherman, yeah, it might need to be sharpened and lubed, but that's not that hard to do. And it's going to essentially be the same as a new one after a week. So yeah, I would buy a used Leatherman in a heartbeat. Used jack stands? I would inspect them, but you know, if they were a decent brand name, like, you know, even if it was just Craftsman, yeah, sure, I'd buy used jack stands. I would trust that. A used electric inflator? I would probably shy away from that, because that is a high entropy device, as they say. And the new ones aren't that expensive. And I've been recommending these battery-powered tire inflators for a while now. They just really, really work well, and they take up very little space, and you don't have to fight with cords. The whole point of this is not to give you, here are the guidelines for how to buy good stuff versus cheap stuff, etc. It's to get you to think about it. Whenever you're going to buy something for your van, you have to consider, is this a capital investment? Is this something that is super important or something going to be using all the time or that I want to last for 10 years? You know, cookware is a good example of that. Do you want to buy a cheap frying pan that you're going to replace in 2 years, or do you want to buy a good one that you're going to replace in 10 years? Your choice. That is not a life-critical thing, but I do know that using cheap cookware is a pain in the butt, and you'll end up wasting food and time cleaning it because they won't clean as well. That's the kind of thinking I'm trying to get you to embrace here, and I don't think there are any wrong decisions here, except that you will learn from what you've done and maybe wish you hadn't done it. Tech Talk. How to read reviews. This is sort of a Tech Talk thing, but it sort of isn't, but it is, because this applies to everything. Whenever you're looking for a product, whatever it is, You can find all kinds of reviews online, usually. There are the Amazon reviews. There are Walmart reviews. There is YouTube reviews. There's TikTok reviews. I mean, reviews are everywhere for every product. And it's gotten weird now because we have influencers who often have reasons not to give honest reviews. And that is subtle. And I am one of those to some extent. I don't consider myself an influencer, but I do have companies giving me products for review. Now, I have very strict rules on that. I never accept payment. I only accept the product, and they have to give it to me knowing that I am going to do the review honestly, whether it is favorable or not. Now, in some cases, they insert a little clause that if you're going to do an unfavorable review, don't do the review. And I have some qualms about this, but I do accept that. In fact, it just happened. I had another stereo sent to me for my truck, and I won't mention the brand name, but I couldn't get it to work right. It after months of going back and forth, and they sent me a new unit. They actually sent me two units. I still can't get it to work right. I don't know exactly what's going on, but I've worked with their techs and everything. We can't get it to work. So obviously, I can't recommend a product that doesn't work well, and so I'm not. And that video never got made, and that's the end of that. They sent me two units. They're not getting them back. I mean, I could send them back if they wanted them, but they don't care. So, okay, so that's not happening. And I just got another one to review, because apparently I am the 2019 Ram 1500 Classic Radio Review Guy, suddenly. I don't know, but this one's really nice. So I'm going to give it a try, and I'll talk about that when I install it, or not, we'll see. So that adds this weird complexity to things, because you do have companies paying people to review their products, and you also have companies who will just send people stuff for review, and then if it's a bad review, ask you not to publish it. And the problem with that is that you only ever see good reviews for this product. Well, I looked at all the reviews, and they're good. So when you're looking at video reviews, what you want to do is avoid situations like me. Any video that I've done for a product, while they've been fair and I've talked about pros and cons, they have been mostly positive because there was this condition by which I wouldn't post a negative one. It's a little deceiving. Also, it is well known in the influencer circles that if you post positive reviews of something and people pay attention to it, you will get more stuff. That's how it works. These companies now have a network or some kind. I'm on some list that I didn't sign up for where here's an influencer who has had successful videos selling stuff, you know, for us. And because of that, I get offers for stuff all the time. Most of it I just turned down. A lot of it has nothing to do with van life. Others, I've gotten probably 10 offers for car stereos for the truck. And I just am not going to constantly tear apart my dashboard and have to reprogram something. So I'm only doing new ones if it's honestly an interesting new stereo. But I've gotten all kinds of stuff. And sometimes I'll say, sure. I've like a bunch of fridges. I've done a bunch of fridges. And I'll say, sure, send me the fridge. I'll try it. And if somebody wants to do this kind of stuff, here's the formula. Only post positive reviews. Do a whole bunch of stuff that you bought yourself that they didn't send you. Like anything you buy, do a video review of it. Do a 5-minute TikTok, whatever. And they will send you more and more and more stuff. That is how it happens. So how do you tell what's actually good? Well, you have to look for the 3-star reviews. I mean, that is kind of the general way to look at it. You don't want to read too many of the, this is excellent. And also, if you're like on Amazon or whatever, you don't want to read too many of the 1-star reviews, because a lot of times they're just cranky people. Unless they're like all 1-star reviews and that sets a pattern, you'll notice that if you read the 1-star reviews, it's going to be people like, well, it arrived late, or the color wasn't as orange as I expected, or it weighed more, or they simply didn't read the description and missed something like, this is 110 volts, I need it for 12 volts, you know. You'll see that stuff a lot, and because of that, you can basically just throw those away. 5-star reviews, you can throw them away too. So another way to look at this is just read the 2, 3, and 4-star reviews on Amazon or whatever, and you're going to get the best picture. The other part of this that isn't necessarily obvious is that a product with more reviews should have more weight than a product with few reviews. So if you have a product with 100 reviews and a 4.5 rating, and then you have a product with 10,000 reviews and a 3.9 rating, which is better? And believe it or not, the 3.9 is probably better because that is a vetted number. The reliability of the number is much stronger than the 4 point whatever it was on the other one because there's so few reviews. This is Bayesian reasoning, Bayesian analysis. You can look that up if you'd like. But the idea is that the number of reviews matters almost as much as the quality of reviews, if not more. I will trust a 3.9 from 10,000 reviews a lot more than a 4.5 from 100 reviews. Unless it's a brand new product, it's something I'm familiar with, I will trust that better. That doesn't necessarily mean I want a 3.9 star product, but that is a much more reliable number. And the other thing you have to do is just spread it out as much as possible. One thing I like to do is whenever I'm looking at a product and considering buying it, I will type into Google or whatever now, ChatGPT or Reddit or whatever, product XYZ sucks, or product XYZ, this thing sucks, or product XYZ, don't buy, and then read the things there. Now, the influencers have caught on to people doing that, and they will title their things to catch those searches, such as, don't buy this until you watch this review. And then you watch the review, and you're like, they gave them this thing, and they love it, of course, and you know it doesn't actually tell you anything. Critical thinking is what we're talking about here. Separating your bias and the bias of the reviewer from the actual quality of the product. And one of the biggest things that you have to overcome when evaluating how good something is how much you want it, how cool it is. You know, I've seen a lot of really cool AI pins and stuff like that, and AI glasses, and I'm like, that sounds really cool, because I'm somebody who actually likes AI. I would love some of that stuff. I have not bought any of them. None of them, because I have done my own Bayesian analysis of the reviews and determined that none of these things are going to make me happy. They're not going to improve my life, and a heck of a lot of them disappear after 6 months and you've spent a couple $100 on just a dead product. If I let my emotions dictate, I would buy them all, or I would have at least bought a couple. And, well, I'm old enough and wise enough now that I don't let that happen. So this is a van life skill we're talking about here. It may not involve setting up a battery or a solar panel or fixing a transmission or anything like that, but it is a skill that will definitely improve your van life as you learn to read reviews and analyze them for your own personal uses. I'm going to give you one last case, and this is the one that most people disagree with me on. Berkey filters. I don't think they're in business anymore. I don't know. But there was a time when the ultimate van life water filtration system was a Berkey filter. It looked like a giant coffee maker, and it had some proprietary plastic filters in it and all this. People loved them. They swore by them. They liked the taste of the water. It was always pure, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This was the kind of thing that you could find van life influencers pushing constantly. They were expensive, strangely hard to put in a van. They didn't have the ergonomics necessarily for a van, but super popular. So if you're new to van life, this is like obviously the no-brainer thing to get. This is what everyone's using. Yeah, the reason I am not a fan of these things is because they make claims they can't prove. Their water purity claims are not proven. And when they were asked to test those using science, they refused. And there is evidence to suggest that they don't actually filter the water very well. That's a good enough reason for me never to buy one, not to mention the fact that it's really hard to mount it in your van. But that's me. I am not the guy that goes along with everybody else. I'm going to take the time to look at it. And I'm not always right by any means. I make a lot of mistakes. But I think in the long run, that helps me determine which products are decent and which aren't based on reviews. It's always better to be able to test the thing yourself. But in the weird world we live in now, most of the stuff we buy, we never see until it arrives at our doorstep. So that's not always an option. Product review. This is John's fault yet again. Hiker John and his wife Wendy are buying really cool stuff, and they showed it all to me at Rocky Mountain Star Stair, and well, now I have to buy it. And I did. This thing is the Zovair Cordless Electric Air Duster. Zovair. And why do you need a cordless electric air duster? Well, having an air duster in a van is actually kind of a good thing, because if you're out there driving around, you know, the door seals never seal 100%. You can fight with that all the time. But if you're driving down dirt roads for 20 miles, you're going to get dust in your van. And sometimes, you know, if it's on the floor, you can just sweep it up. But sometimes that dust gets in places that you have to get it out. And I know certain vans have certain, like, crevices that fill up with stuff, such as the rain gutters and the sliders and ProMasters. You know, I know you guys have all kinds of problems in front of the window there with those scoops that get water in the wrong place under the engine. So a canned air, you know, those things work pretty well, but you've got this can, it runs out, and then you've got to throw away the can. What if there was an electric version of that? And that's kind of where this thing starts. It is a handheld device about the size of a big remote control, because I'm American and I can't give you actual measurements. And it's got a trigger. It kind of sort of looks like a gun, although the handle is much longer than the barrel. And you pull the trigger and air comes out. But that's where things get interesting. The air that comes out in four different speeds. And speed four is incredibly powerful to the point of being dangerous. There are certain body parts you would not want to point this at because you could have problems. It's also so powerful that the thing heats up. It is using the battery and the handle to its fullest extent, and it even tells you in the instructions that if you use it for a long time at this super high speed, you have to let it cool down by running it in the low speed for a bit. All that is to say, this thing is incredibly powerful. I have not tested it against a can of canned air to see if it's just as powerful, but I wouldn't be surprised. And to enhance the effect, it comes with 892 little attachments, like way too many attachments and brushes and all these things. That's a gimmick. You don't need all that. But some of those attachments are designed to do things like blow dust out of keyboards or to disperse the air to kind of blow dust off the floor, or to do a more gentle approach and diffuse it, like if you're going to blow the dust off a screen or something like that. Those are actually genuinely useful. I really like this thing. It's not cheap. It was $37 or so, and that's on sale. I think it retails for $50, but you know how that goes. But this thing is going to be used all the time in your van, I'm pretty sure. It's just great at blowing stuff. That's all it does. Are there some cons? Well, the overheating thing is one, although it is hard to put it in that high speed mode. You have to press the button 3 times to get to high, and then you've got to press it twice to get to super high, and then you have to hold the button down. So you're only going to use that under certain circumstances. The battery life is fine, but that's just not to say that it is long. I don't think you're going to be able to use this for half an hour with the battery still being good for another use. But that's not how you use these things. You use these things a minute or 2 minutes at a time. So that's fine. Yes, you can use it to charge your phone in an emergency, but who cares now? The biggest drawback of this thing is probably the noise. It is loud. This thing seems to be based on those turbo fans that I talked about a little bit ago, where it's just a little personal fan that blows a very concentrated amount of air. It's a similar design. It is not the same thing. This thing has metal fan blades because it spins so fast, plastic would be dangerous. So it's no joke. This is a real useful tool. It produces an incredibly strong jet of air. And if you're in a situation where you're constantly blowing things off or constantly buying those cans, or you're using something else that just isn't quite that powerful, this pocket device might actually be what you need. Oh, you say, can you use it as an inflator? Yes and no. You could use this to inflate, say, a float or a mattress or something like that, but not a tire. It does not have a Schrader valve attachment, and it doesn't have any way to keep pressure, if that makes any sense. It will blow air, but it can't maintain pressure. You know, if you block the end, the air's just going to come out the other way, and it's going to make all kinds of noise. Did I mention noise? This thing is crazy, crazy loud. But so what? I mean, it's a tool. It's okay. You're not going to be sleeping with this thing on. So I've got a link in the show notes. It's $37 right now on Amazon. It's $50 retail. Prices, we talked about pricing last week. They go all over the place. But yeah, I can honestly recommend this thing. I bought it with my own money. I did not get this for free, which I should start saying more and more often. But yes, the Zolvair cordless electric air duster. Not something that I knew I needed, but I feel like I need it now. Tales from the road. Okay, so I have not been... I let's just say that I've been fairly self-deprecating on some of these tales, and I'm okay with that. I mean, I think that's honest, and I sometimes do stupid things. And, well, I did a stupid thing last week. Now, this is not directly related to van life, because I was not driving my van. I was driving a tractor. But I think it illustrates a point that's very, very close to van life. So I'm at the river property. This is on the Illinois River in LaSalle County, and we own 4 acres on a bend on the river. We kind of own the outer edge of the bend. And when it floods, which happens fairly often, the water comes up, and we've got like benches. You know, there's normal levels where the water will be, and lately it's been pretty high, and it's been higher than normal. In fact, the water is at a level where I usually drive. And what's there right now is a bunch of brush and trees, honestly, and I'm trying to get rid of them because they block our view and they're right on the bank and they prevent our access to the river and all this stuff. Now, you know, use a chainsaw, whatever. Okay, but I am lazy and I happen to have 2 tractors. I have a Kubota and a John Deere, you know, the little ones, not the super little ones, but not like I'm going to plow 40 acres with these things. I've got it's a 1025R and a, what is it? It's a 2370 for the Kubota. Anyway, doesn't matter. They both have front end loaders. So I would go down in the Kubota and cut the grass and then with the front end loader on. And then when I was done cutting the grass, I would spend a little bit of time basically pushing trees over. It's fine. It's ugly, but it works. And it certainly saves a lot of time. And it's not as risky as using a chainsaw, depending. And I was pushing and pushing and pushing, and then I noticed this funny smell. It was like the smell of wet, not wet dog, but like wet heat. That's what it smelled like. And it's like, what is that? And I noticed that the front wheels of the tractor were in the river. And you might think, well, how could you not notice that? And it's because there was this layer of debris floating on the river that looked like dirt. I mean, this was like some Scooby-Doo quicksand moment. You couldn't see that the water was there. And I was paying attention to the trees because I didn't want them to fall on me. And I had rolled down a slight slope. And yeah, the front wheels of the tractor were in the water. And I'm like, I better stop now. Because the risk wasn't the water. The risk was that I couldn't see the terrain and the sides of the slope go steep into the river. And I very easily could have rolled the tractor into the river, which would have been a much more serious problem. So I was like, okay, hula dancers. Now, 4-wheel drive tractor, I lifted up the front end loader and I was able to just easily back out. The front wheels came out of the river. No problem. I was like, I'll tackle these trees later when the river goes down. Fine. A couple weeks go by. I now have this John Deere. Suddenly, that was not a plan. Just things happened and now I have a John Deere. It has a front-end loader on it, too. It's a very similar size tractor, but this one's much newer and has a little bit more power. Now, and I don't use this for cutting the grass now. This is just my maintenance tractor, and I turned the Kubota kind of into a full-time lawnmower for now. So I cut the grass, take the Kubota, park it, I go get the John Deere, and I'm going to do my pushing down trees thing again. And, you know, I'm aware that the river's there, and I figure, well, now that I know it's there, I'll avoid it. And the river's gone down a little bit. And so I go down, I push over some trees, I'm trying to figure out the best way, you know, can I wedge the front end loader under there and lift him up and stuff. And then, what's that smell? Oh, here we go again. I start smelling that wet heat. I'm like, yeah, the front of the tractor is in the river. Oh, how dumb is that? I did it twice. Okay, well, four-wheel drive, same thing, and I back out, and no, this is not coming out. One of the differences between the 1025R, John Deere, and the Kubota 2370, or 20, is that what it's, whatever the heck it is the tires. And I have talked a lot about how in van life, the tires matter more than the four-wheel drive in many cases. The tires on the Kubota are what are called turf tires, and they're designed to run over grass and so that when you turn, you won't damage the grass very much. But they're also very good at other things. One of them is they're very good on snow, and also they're very good in soft conditions like this. They're not the best tires in mud. The best tires in mud are agricultural tires like you see on the big tractors doing the back 40. But those are terrible for grass. They will totally tear up your grass. So the John Deere doesn't have either of those. What it has on it are basically industrial tires. These are tires meant to be used on pavement, on hard surfaces. And they are the worst in soft conditions. Four-wheel drive is great, but when you step on the pedal to go backwards and your four-wheel drive has wheels spinning in the front and back, that's a real problem. I'm like, okay, well, let's take a moment and figure out what I'm going to do here. So most tractors of any size have a foot pedal that you can step on and it will lock the differential in the rear wheels, making it so both rear wheels will turn in a situation like this. It's a little risky because there's a pin that can break in the transmission if you do this wrong. You have to step on the pedal before you apply the gas. But I know how to do this, so that's fine. So I do that. I step on the pedal, and the thing lurches backwards and spins, making a hole, making it harder for me to get out. So I'm in a situation where I have one front wheel spinning, both back wheels spinning, and this thing is in the river. And I'm actually getting closer to the river. So what do you do? Based on experience and my ability to know that don't dig deeper, first rule, when you're digging a hole that you want to get out of, stop digging. I put the thing in neutral, set my foot on the brake, and just sat there and considered the problem. And I realized, okay, well, I could put this in neutral and get the other tractor and pull it out. You know, that would probably work. If that didn't work, I could get my truck and drive down there with some difficulty and pull it out with that, because big, heavy truck is going to beat a little tractor any day of the week. And then I realized I've got a front-end loader. So the front-end loader is this big scoop at the front of the tractor that you use to like pick up things and dump them. You've seen them. You know what I'm talking about. But it's also this big articulating pushing force. And this is a trick that everybody with these little tractors has learned. That is, if you get stuck, don't rely on the wheels to get you out. Rely on the front end loader, because you can basically push the front end loader into the ground and then curl the bucket and it will push you backwards. You're basically digging yourself out with the actual tractor that's in the hole. The front end loader is strong enough to lift up the entire front end of the tractor. And because of that, it has enough strength to actually lift the front wheels over whatever the problem is and then push backwards. And when you combine that motion with your foot down locking the differential and going in reverse in low gear, four-wheel drive, yeah, you'll usually get out. And that's exactly what I did. It only took one try, and out I came. Why am I telling you this story? Because it illustrates several points of what to do in cases of emergency. One is stop digging. Stop. The other is consider all your resources, not just the ones that are obvious. I considered the tractor, I considered the truck, I considered the front end loader, which solved the problem. And the number three thing, and the hardest of this, is experience. I knew to do this because I had gotten stuck before. When I first got my Kubota, I got stuck, I think, the first day, just in a muddy patch of dirt. I got really stuck because I didn't know what to do. I dug myself down so that the frame of the tractor was in the mud, which is a terrible situation. And I did know enough to stop at that point. I took a picture and posted it on Facebook to a Kubota group and said, well, now I've done it. And they were like, yeah, but you know how to get out, right? And I was like, well, yeah, I was going to hook my truck up to it. And they're like, no, just use the front end loader. And I was like, oh, of course. I would not have been able to solve this problem this quickly if I hadn't have had that experience. So it's a story. You can do with it what you like. But I think the main takeaway is don't drive into the river and don't do it twice. Jeez. A place to visit. This probably should be in a different section, but it's my podcast and I'm going to do what I'd like. I would like you to consider visiting a ReStore. This is R-E, capital STORE, Restore. These are, I guess you could call them thrift stores, but they're not really, organized by Habitat for Humanity. Habitat for Humanity is a religious organization that builds houses for people. Jimmy Carter was famously associated with these guys. They basically say, hey, we're going to build these people a house, and they go and do it, and it doesn't cost the people in the house anything, except in some cases sweat equity, where they might ask them to help out. I have worked on some of these through Team Rubicon, and while I am normally not terribly in favor of religious organizations, in my experience with Habitat for Humanity, the religion might be the reason they're doing it, but what they're doing has really nothing to do with religion. It's about getting the house built, and I can certainly get on board with that. But this isn't about building a house. This is about them coming up with a solution to a problem they had where they would have a lot of stuff left over after they built these houses, and they would get donations, and they literally had nothing they could do with them. For example, they might be building 20 houses in 1 year, but they've received 400 sinks as a donation. Well, what do you do with the other sinks? And the answer is restore. I know of a few different ones in Illinois, and you can find out where they are if you go to habitat.org/restores. And they carry all different kinds of stuff for building homes, basically. But that also means you can build vans with this stuff. And you never know what you're going to find. One of my favorite things here for van life is that they sell cabinets and furniture, like just weird one-off stuff. Stuff that really, you couldn't, you know, it's like one cabinet from a kitchen. What are you going to do with that? Well, you're going to put it in your van and mount a sink in it, and boom, there's that solution for you. You're done. You don't have to be a cabinet maker. You've got the cabinet right there. And some of them are really good quality. I mean, you can find a metal cabinet from 1940, you know, one of those vermin-proof cabinets that you could put in your van. Or sometimes they will just have lumber, or they will have flooring, like they'll have half-open boxes of flooring, which wouldn't be enough in a house, but maybe that's enough for your van. I got a whole bunch of insulating felt that is an underlayment for carpet that I used in my first van. It was a nice, thin, semi-insulation that fit in some places perfectly. They've got all kinds of stuff. And you, I know you've heard of Salvation Army and Goodwill and places like that, but this is different because the stuff is nearly all focused on building homes and thus vans. It's a fun place to go, if nothing else. You can go there looking to solve a particular problem, or what I actually recommend is when you're starting a van build, just go there and get ideas. Consider that this cabinet that you are going to build, you can actually just buy one that's close enough for $50. And then, you know, you sure you can cut it or whatever or take it apart. I mean, this is a place for creative problem-solving people, and it supports a good cause, in my opinion. I think Habitat for Humanity is a good thing, and I'm happy to have supported them in the past and continue to support them by visiting Restores. So go to habitat.org/restores. They're in the U.S. and Canada. And see if you can find one near you or on one of your trips, and just stop by and take a look. You might see nothing. You might just find nothing that fits, or you might find that amazing solution you had no idea was exactly what you needed. And that is a very cool moment when that happens. Resource recommendation. There are some screws or bolts that you use in your van that are very, very important that you don't want to mess with. You know, you can get by with zip screws or self-tappers sometimes, but there are times when you actually really want the right thing. And sometimes you'll have one, but you don't know what it is to buy more. Like, it's not like screws say, well, this is an 8mm, you know, they just don't have that information on them. So how do you find out what they are? Well, you can buy guides, you know, the plastic guides and stuff, but they're really not as good as the best solution, which I have found at Menards has the best, in my opinion, but Home Depot and Lowe's also have these. If you look in the screw aisle, they typically will have something mounted to the wall that will help you determine the thread size and thread type of different screws. For example, did you know that, say, machine screws have a fine thread, but then like lag bolts will have a coarse thread? The threads matter. It's not just the size, it's also the threads. So the way you can figure these things out is that they have these basically a collection of nuts and bolts mounted to the wall, and you can just bring your screw and see where it fits. And then it'll say, this is an M8 1 inch or whatever, and then you can just buy them right there. This simple little tip has saved my butt so many times, because for some reason I have screws and I need more of them and I don't know where they are because I lost the box or they were found or they were already in the van. Now, there's a whole lot to learn about screws. They're much more complicated than they seem, especially bolts. They have strengths. They have metal types. And for things like, let's say you lost a bolt from your hitch, your tow hitch, yeah, you don't want to just go buy something that fits. You have to buy the right heavy-duty thing. So you want to do research on something like that. But for the specific problem of finding out what size they are so you can order more, this is a great resource. So Menards has a great one. Also, check Home Depot and Lowe's. They have them too. And if nothing else, it will help you learn the difference between SAE screws and metric screws, because they have two totally different sections for those. It has really saved my bacon a few times in a way that the little plastic ones you get from Amazon can't. Being able to actually screw it into something and see how easy it fits in there just is so much more reassuring than saying, well, it's kind of 8 millimeters, I don't know. Thank you for listening to the very last episode in the 200s. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. And if you're looking for some van life community, well, there's a lot of it out there. But we have a Discord server and we have a Facebook group. And you can find them at builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. Until next time, remember the words popularized by Rita Mae Brown, who said, good judgment comes from experience. And experience comes from bad judgment.